campus versus the city of Peoria and the city of Peoria Police Department.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court, counsel. My name's Kevin Jacobs. I represent the plaintiff appellant in this case. We really have a fairly focused and simple question for this court to consider and answer, and it involves the court's prior decision in the case of Stone versus City of Indianapolis. In that case, the court set forth two methods by which summary judgment could be granted or could be avoided in a retaliation case. We submit that Magistrate Judge Gorman in the court below erred in his application of Stone versus City of Indianapolis. We believe that Magistrate Judge Gorman read Stone versus City of Indianapolis to mean that there could never be a case where temporal proximity was direct evidence of discrimination or retaliation. We believe that reading of Stone is incorrect. In fact, Stone itself, which this court only recently decided, leaves open the door to have temporal proximity as a consideration. In Stone, this court noted that we remind that mere temporal proximity between the filing of the charge of discrimination and the action alleged to have been taken in retaliation for filing will rarely be sufficient in and of itself to create a tribal issue. And I know the court has indicated it's going to be rarely sufficient, but by saying that, that's different than what the court below said, which basically indicated that it could never be create a tribal issue. We believe in this case it does, and we believe it does for the following reasons. There really is something here a bit more than mere temporal proximity when we look at the facts that are involved. The episode that ultimately led to the city of Peoria firing my client involved a simunitions training exercise conducted on September 23, 1999. Simunitions, for lack of a better description, is use of ammunition similar to paintballs, where they're not shooting live rounds out of the guns, but they're shooting paintballs out of the guns so they can see what they hit and what targets they hit. My client was involved in a simunition training exercise conducted by the City of Peoria Police Department on September 23, 1999. That exercise was conducted in a closed building. It was dark inside the building. At the time of the particular exercise at issue, my client was part of a team that was going from room to room in the building, clearing the building, and there were various scenarios that were being played out. It was alleged that my client, in this darkened room, shot a suspect who was in surrendering position three times in the back. That was the testimony from certain of the observers that were at the scene. My client's testimony is that he did not do that. My client's testimony is that when his partner had been shot by one of the suspects in the room, if you will, that my client noticed another individual who was hiding in the room, and he fired at the wall near where that individual was hiding, but he did not fire at the individual in order to try and get the individual to comply with his orders to assume a surrender position. It wasn't so much my client's actions that were important during the simunition training exercise to the police department, however. It was statements that my client allegedly made during the debriefing that occurred after the exercise. It's alleged that my client made statements to the effect that, well, if shots are fired from this room, I'm entitled to go in and shoot anybody in the room.
Shots fired from this room?
If shots were fired from the room, I'm entitled to go in and shoot anybody in the room. Now, that's a pretty outlandish statement to make if you're an officer who's been trained, and my client had a training at the University of Illinois Police Training Institute. No decently trained law enforcement officer is going to make a statement like that. He's also alleged to have said in this debriefing that, well, for example, there was allegedly a scenario raised that, well, if there's a car and there are several people in a car and shots come out of the car, are you allowed to fire at the car? And it's alleged that my client said, well, yeah, I can shoot everybody in the car if shots come out of the car. Again, something that someone who is a well-trained or even decently trained police officer wouldn't say. My client denied making those statements. And one of the The only witnesses to that incident were people that were employed by the City of Peoria Police Department. One officer, Officer Cioli, testified in his deposition that he was there at the debriefing, that he did not recall my client making those statements, that those statements were so outlandish that had my client made them, he would have recalled making them. So we have the testimony of my client who denied making the statements and the testimony of another officer that supports that denial. Why is that important? Well, if those statements have been made by my client, and the city's position is those statements show that my client is such a risk that he shouldn't be on the street with a gun, that he shouldn't be employed as a police officer. And I would agree, if you have a police officer that's going to actually believe something along those lines, that would certainly constitute a risk to public safety, and that the city, the employing entity, should take action to protect the public from someone that is that off the wall in terms of their beliefs in use of deadly force. But what we have here, and this gets to the temporal proximity issue, the training exercise took place on September 23, 1999. There was no formal investigation initiated by the department, until November 12, 1999. Now, if these statements were so onerous and my client represented such a risk to the public, why was there such a time delay in instituting a formal investigation? We're talking about well over a month before a formal investigation was initiated. Now, the city may point out, well, there was an informal investigation that was done. And purportedly there was. There were two sergeants who were supposed to be in charge of this ammunition training exercise. They were not there at the time of the exercise. They were not there when these events happened, and they only heard about them about a week afterwards. Yet these two individuals who were not there, didn't take part, didn't observe it, they were the ones that conducted this informal investigation a little bit earlier.
Well, wouldn't you say that was sensible? If you take the people who are there and start the informal investigation, it's over before it begins.
If it might be sensible if the informal investigation was really designed to do something other than to create some sort of paper trail.
But the fact of having outside people who are not present conduct the informal investigation is an intelligent way to investigate, isn't it?
One could look at it that way, but another way...
What other way would look at it? The other way is they have the fox decide whether or not there was a fox in the hen house.
Well, you had people there, Your Honor, that were supposed to be in charge of the training exercise.
I know, but we're talking about an informal investigation of what occurred. You'd have outside people do it if you were doing it appropriately, wouldn't you?
And I think in terms of doing that, you would also have the outside people talk to all the relevant players.
That might be, but the fact of the outside people to conduct the investigation is an intelligent investigative tool, is it not?
It is, but the problem that we have with it, Your Honor, is that these individuals were associated with other individuals in the department that had caused problems for my client in the past.
Ah, you're questioning their bias, not the fact that they were outside, but they were outside with
Yes, Your Honor.
An agenda. Go ahead.
Yes, thank you, Your Honor. In fact, the sergeants that were involved were part of a SWAT team. The sergeant who allegedly was shot in the back was also part of the SWAT team. They had served together. They had close relationships. There was inconsistent testimony even among the people that were there about the sergeant who was shot, who was allegedly in the surrendering position, claimed that he wasn't wearing a flak vest or a bulletproof vest. And the sergeant who was actually in charge of the exercise that day said, no, everybody had to wear them during the exercise. Well, the point of that was, if the person who was shot had his flak vest on, he would not feel the shots when they hit him in the back. So he had to say that they weren't that there wasn't anything there.
Hasn't he been involved in a lot of things on the department, though, where they've had investigations?
There, Your Honor, there were a number of things that
May
were involved.
May 7th, May 14th, November 12th, all in the year. I mean, it seems like he's had problems all the way along. April?
But I think the court needs to look beyond the fact that there were those types of problems and look at the seriousness or gravity of those problems.
Yeah, but when you've got an officer that's continually having problems, you're opening yourself up to future liability.
It depends on...
But he's exercising this bad judgment when they can keep suspending him.
It depends on the seriousness of the problem, Your Honor. Thank you. I would like to reserve the time for rebuttal.
Please, the court, counsel. I think the focus in this case is what was the correct standard for summary judgment, and the district court here, Judge Gorman, determined that there was no direct evidence of protected activity, and as a result, the suffering of an adverse employment action.
What's the size of the Peoria Police Department?
Approximately 250 officers.
General longevity, how long?
It's a relatively young department now, probably average around 12 to 15 years.
Wow. Good.
They had a lot of new hires with the federal bill here a few years ago. Most of the officers who were involved as trainers in this had 20 years or more on the department. I think counsel's point that the Stone Court left open the possibility of a temporal proximity being the sole argument is really not a factor here, because counsel has really introduced nothing to show that there was any real connection between the investigation and the filing of a charge questionnaire or an actual charge. The incident occurred on September 23rd. It's undisputed that the informal investigation began within a week. It's also uncontradicted in the record that it went on through the chain of command. There is no evidence presented that a month or even 2 months is an untoward length of time to conduct an investigation of this type. Why was the officer left on the street in view of this? Well, it was the superintendent of police who was the ultimate decision maker, who, when he was presented with the findings of the formal investigation, did put Officer Campos on administrative leave, took him off the street, and gave him the option to resign, or he would be, the chief would be seeking his discharge. The district court ruled that that's an illusory choice and was really no choice at all, with which we would respectfully disagree, because in this case, unlike the other cases cited, the officer had union protection, and had he chosen to challenge the discharge, he could have done so by filing a grievance through his union, and under the union bylaws, he could pursue that grievance without the union if he chose to. So we think it was a voluntary resignation.
He wouldn't do that, though.
I'm sorry, sir.
I said they asked for his resignation, and the hope and expectation that he wouldn't do that.
That's an easy way out.
Well, as is in the record, it's been the policy and practice on the department when an officer is found or believed to have committed acts serious enough to warrant discharge that he or she be given the option of resigning rather than have the discharge on their record. And as Officer Campos here testified...
Well, that's a common practice in a lot of organizations, but I'm not sure I understand why that isn't... can amount to a discharge or be tantamount to a discharge.
Well, I would say because the officer has two choices. One, he can fight the discharge with the assistance of his union and keep his job if he prevails. Two, he can choose not to fight, or as in this case, he said he thought it would look better on his record. It would help him get another job if he resigned. And it's our position that that was a choice. It was a voluntary resignation. But be that as it may, the issue here that we're focusing on is, was there evidence here that should defeat the summary judgment motion? We suggest there is not. There was no direct evidence that any adverse employment action was taken against Officer Campos because of his protected activity. His prior record was terrible. He had 3 suspensions, and he had only been on the department approximately 4.5 years. In the McDonnell Douglas type of analysis, it's incumbent upon the plaintiff to show that after filing the charge, he and only he suffered an adverse employment action, even though he was performing satisfactorily. Well, clearly he was not performing satisfactorily, and that's undisputed. It is also undisputed, in fact, plaintiff has agreed in their statement of facts that Chief Stenson believes that Officer Campos' alleged actions and statements made during the September 23, 1999 simulations training showed a problem with his attitude and ability to carry out his duties as a police officer. That is a legitimate, non-discriminatory reason. And we suggest that whether there was some dispute in the evidence during the investigation is not the issue here. The issue is, what did Superintendent Stenson, the decision maker, believe at the time he made the decision? And it is undisputed and conceded here that he believed that the reasons he stated were, in fact, the reasons. This was not pretext, was not a lie. He, in fact, believed that Officer Campos had a problem with attitude and ability to take direction. If there are no questions, that would be our presentation.
Counsel, do you have anything to add, please?
Yes, sir.
Just briefly, Your Honor, I think because this was a summary judgment, we're entitled to reasonable inferences from the facts that are in the record. And I think one of the things the court needs to keep in mind is this informal investigation that's alluded to. They never once talked to Jose Campos. How can you have any kind of meaningful investigation if you don't talk to the person at issue? I would also take issue that my client's prior record was terrible. The suspensions that were talked about were for rather picayune things.
But even so, they're violations of department rules.
But the department can find violations where violations may or may not exist.
Did he challenge them?
He
were
could.
Were they overturned?
He did. And the punishment that was handed down was overturned by
the punishment, but was the violation turned out?
No, it was not.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, counsel. We will proceed to case number 5, please.